I'd like you to find your way back to Ezekiel chapter number 37 today, as we're kind of talking about the Gog-Magog war that takes place at the end of the millennium there in the book of Revelation chapter 20. And that's actually where our study right now is in the book of Revelation. But I want to make it perfectly clear that the Gog-Magog war in Revelation 20 is, in fact, given with much more detail in Ezekiel chapters 38 and 39. And I'm going to show you some key places once we get into those two chapters that will, I think, very clearly prove that. It does not take place before the millennium, as I hear some prophecy teachers trying to speculate. But in order to understand chapters 38 and 39, you really need to start in chapter 37 with the whole valley of dry bones that are resurrected and the spirit is put back into them, and then they become an example or a stand-in, a metaphor for the whole house of Israel from Ezekiel's time, which was all dried up. They were having problems between northern Israel, southern Judah, and the sin that brought both of them into exile. But a prophecy is made in that context that at some point in the future, God is going to bring them back together into one group. They won't be northern Israel and southern Judah anymore. They will be one nation under one king. Now, the speculation that some people will immediately jump into is the idea that when they came back from Assyrian and Babylonian exile, in the time of Zerubbabel and Joshua the high priest, and even Ezra after them, and Nehemiah at the same time as Ezra, that it is true that it didn't matter which tribe you were from anymore. You were all Jews. You were all one people group. And so that aspect of this prophecy is most certainly true at the time of the return a few hundred years before Jesus. However, they had no king. When they came back into the land, there was no Davidic king over them, ever. The only period of kings over the Jews that happened was under the Hasmoneans, who were actually from the tribe of Levi. They were descendants of Aaron, and therefore it was a priest-king sort of thing, and it was an aberration. So this prophecy can't be completely about that. Now, others would then immediately say, yes, but then Jesus came, and that's true. And he is our king. That's true as well. But he didn't stick around and rule over the Israelis at this time in the first century, did he? His first coming was all about dying and rising again for the forgiveness of sin in individual people's lives and the filling of them with the indwelling of the Holy Spirit. His second coming is going to be all about the kingdom that is established in the new heaven and new earth, a place in which righteousness exists. And so with that sort of background here, I want to dive back into Ezekiel chapter 37, and we're going to start reading at verse 21, where the prophet Ezekiel says, this is what God says, "Behold, I will take the people of Israel from the nations among which they have gone, and will gather them all around and bring them into their own land." Now, that was what I was just referencing a little bit ago, is that some people think this is all about the coming back out of the Assyrian and Babylonian exiles. Others, after acknowledging that that didn't work out so well as a permanent situation, they will start talking about things happening in the late 1800s and then the establishment of the modern state of Israel in the 1940s, and then how people, Israelis of all the different tribal groups, have been streaming back to the land since then. And so they will say, that was fulfilled here. Well, let's keep reading and see if that is how it was fulfilled. It says, I will gather them from all around and bring them to their own land, and I will make them one nation in the land on the mountains of Israel, and one king will be king over them. They shall no longer be two nations and no longer divided into two kingdoms. So it's true, the modern Jews in the modern state of Israel are one nation. They do not have two kingdoms, northern Israel, southern Judah. So that's definitely true. But do they have a king? No, they do not. They have a parliamentary democracy that is set up there, and every time the majority breaks down in the coalition, they have to have new elections, and the winning coalition gets to decide who the next leader of the country is. That's not a kingdom. And so this is not true about modern Israel. Neither is this next line, verse 23. They shall not defile themselves anymore with their idols and their detestable things or with any of their transgressions. So even though you might make the case that modern Israelis don't have a problem with idolatry, you can't say they don't have a problem with sin, because they most certainly do. The majority of ethnic Israelis living in the state of Israel are secularists. Some of them are outright atheists. They'll tell you that. And so there's definitely sin in the land. So this can't be about the modern state of Israel. Continuing, but I will save them from all the backslidings in which they've sinned and will cleanse them, and they shall be my people, and I will be their God. And we've actually seen that line in other millennial passages that we've applied to the second coming of Jesus and how he sets up his reign at Jerusalem over with his resurrected, transformed immortals. But he's also, according to what we've been kind of gleaning, has a whole bunch of mortals that he is also ruling and reigning over. And so, verse 24, my servant David shall be king over them, and they shall have one shepherd. They shall walk in my rules and be careful to obey my statutes. Now, some people believe that David, in this context, is a stand-in for Jesus. After all, he is the son of David, which was a messianic title that we find in the New Testament. And he most certainly is the one shepherd. I am the good shepherd, he says in John chapter 10. And in the millennium, everybody's going to be walking by his rules and obeying his statutes. So it is possible that David is a representation here of Jesus. But it's also possible to keep in mind that Jesus is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. And in Revelation chapter 20, we are told that his resurrected, transformed saints will be ruling and reigning with him. We already know that Jesus promised to his 12 apostles on two occasions that they would sit on 12 thrones administering the 12 tribes of Israel. So they have some sort of leadership responsibility in the millennial kingdom. That's very clear from Jesus' own teaching. Is it possible, even likely, that David might also be resurrected and be put in such an administrative position? And I would think that that is very possible. Verse 25, though, is going to be getting back to what I want to point. They shall dwell in the land that I gave to my servant Jacob, where your fathers lived. They and their children and their children's children shall dwell there forever. So the people that have been brought back, and the focus here in Ezekiel is clearly on ethnic Israelis, the people who have been brought back into the land are going to live there forever. And that has not happened in past history for the Israelis. And even now, the Israelis that are living in the Promised Land are having a hard time maintaining their security because of the hatred, the anti-Semitism that is shot through the nations around them. But it says, they will live there forever, and David my servant shall be their prince forever. I will make a covenant of peace with them. It will be an everlasting covenant with them. I will set them in their land and multiply them, and will set my sanctuary in their midst forever. Sanctuary means the holy place, the place where the throne of God is. My dwelling place will be with them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Then the ethnic groups, the Goyim, the Gentiles, the nations, will know that I am He who is, who sanctifies Israel, when my sanctuary is in their midst forever. So I would submit to you that that last section of Ezekiel chapter 37 is pretty much a millennial passage, that it is establishing that period of time when Jesus has gathered into his kingdom from all over the place, ethnic Israelis who are underneath his kingdom. And so that is the introduction in the book of Ezekiel to chapters 38 and 39. Remember, there are no chapter divisions in the original text. And that is why I believe that we are on track with understanding that this is the expanded explanation of the Gog-Magog war that we see briefly in Revelation chapter number 20. In fact, why don't we read once again just the few verses of Revelation chapter 20 that describe the Gog-Magog war. Revelation 20, verse 7, when the 1,000 years were ended, Satan, will be released from his prison. He was chained and thrown into the bottomless pit, remember? And he will come out to deceive the nations that are at the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them for battle. And the only other place in Scripture that those names are mentioned in context together as a battle is Ezekiel 38 and 39. To gather them for battle, their number is like the sand of the sea. That's idiomatic for it's a bunch. And they marched up over the broad plain of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city. That would clearly be Jerusalem is the target that they're heading for. But then fire came down from heaven and consumed them. So it really wasn't much of a battle, was it? It was pretty much they were on their way, and God says, nope, I'm done with this, and burns them all up. And what happens to Satan, who was kind of leading them in this fool's errand? Verse 10, and the devil who had deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and sulfur where the beast and the false prophet were, and they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. And that's the last time we ever hear about Satan in the chronology of Earth's history as played out here in the prophetic literature. And so that's all, just those few verses. That's all that's in Revelation chapter 20 about the battle of Gog-Magog. Satan leads it. There's a whole bunch involved in it. They start their march. They get burned up. Satan gets tossed into hell. That's it. But in Ezekiel chapter number 38, we get more details. Verse 1 of Ezekiel 38, the word of he who is came to me, son of man, which is just the word human from our perspective. It was one of the ways that God addressed the prophet Ezekiel on a regular basis. Of course, Jesus becomes human, and the title takes on a whole new sense to it when it's applied to him. So, son of man, set your face toward Gog in the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and prophesy against him. Now, your New American Standard, if you're using that, and there's a couple of other English versions that do the same, they put a capitalized initial letter as if it were a proper noun on a word, Rosh. And I know a lot of premillennial dispensationalists make a big deal out of it because they see in that word Rosh an affinity or a connection with Russia. And I'm going to tell you, there is not. And the English Standard Version does the proper thing here. It understands that in Hebrew, the word Rosh means head. And therefore, it is also the word for a leader or a top leader. And so that's exactly how it should be translated here. And so, son of man, set your face toward Gog, who is the person that's causing the trouble here. I'll get back to him in a moment. Of the land of Magog. And Magog pretty much means in Hebrew the place of Gog. But it's also the name of one of the post-flood progenitors of the different ethnic groups that rise up in the Table of Nations there in Genesis chapter 10. First it's the name of a person, Magog, and then it becomes the name of a place, Magog, which is actually located in what we call modern-day Turkey. I'll come back to that again as well. But then the text goes on to say, properly, that this Gog of Magog is the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. So, Rosh is represented here in the English Standard Version by the word chief. So, he's the head tsar of Meshech. Meshech is another one of the names that you'll find in Genesis chapter number 10. And Tubal, which is another of the names you find in Genesis chapter 10, Table of Nations. Both Meshech and Tubal are located very close to the Turkey area. That whole swath of land that includes Turkey, across through Armenia, Azerbaijan, goes along... I think it's the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. That whole area right there is where you find many of these name places that Ezekiel includes in his text. That's where they were located. All right, so prophesy to this guy, Gog, and say, thus says he who is Elohim, he who is God. Behold, I am against you, O Gog, chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. So who is Gog? Now, a lot of people will teach that Gog is the final enemy, the final world ruler. This is another name for the guy that some of them refer to as Antichrist or somebody that's affiliated with him. It's a big, bad human bad guy. Well, I've got a different take on it, and it's based on some research trying to truck down the meaning of the word Gog. If you go to a lot of the resource material, they will tell you that this Hebrew word Gog cannot be clearly identified as a Hebrew word. It apparently is borrowed from somewhere else. And I believe I found that somewhere else. I decided that I would go and check the Sumerian Dictionary, which is available online. It's a professional language resource tool. And I do not read the Akkadian cuneiform that this dictionary is written in. But thankfully, it has a lot of tools to help those not versed in cuneiform. That's the wedge-shaped writing of the Middle East in the ancient times. It predates our Hebrew alphabet. So there's lots of resources to help you use the material, or lots of helps in the material to help you use the resource. And so I started looking through the Sumerian language, which is apparently the language before the whole Tower of Babylon, Tower of Babel breaking up of the languages happened. And in Sumerian, I found Gug, which is G-U-G in the Sumerian dictionary. Now, I already know, and I think I've shared it with you before, it's commonly understood that in a lot of these ancient languages, they did not have vowels, not in the traditional sense that we do. They focused an awful lot on the consonants. So the GG is what we're looking at here. Gug of Sumeria is going to be probably a potential parallel to Gog or Gog, because it's an actually O sound there, Gog of Hebrew. Now, I've been kind of dancing around it. Let's get to the meat. In Sumerian, the language apparently previous to the Tower of Babel, Gug means brilliant one. And in the Hebrew text of Isaiah chapter 14, we have a record of Satan's original Hebrew name. It is Halel. And Halel in Hebrew literally means brilliant one. So I am convinced beyond any shadow of doubt in my own heart that the Gog of Ezekiel 38 is Satan. It is Satan himself. And so that also parallels the story, as we already understand it from Revelation chapter 20, that Satan is the motivator for this war. And so I will remind you of that as we continue reading the text here in Ezekiel 38. So let's go back to verse 2. Son of man, set your face toward Gog, the brilliant one, Satan, of the land of Magog, or the place of the brilliant one, which is somewhere in Turkey, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, which are also in that same region, which is north of Israel, and prophesy against him, say, thus says he who is God, behold, I am against you, O Gog, brilliant one, Satan, chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and I will turn you about and put hooks into your jaws, and I will bring you out, and all your army, horses and horsemen, all of them clothed in full armor, a great host, all of them with buckler and shield, wielding swords. So this is a description of that army that is going to be pouring out with Satan egging it on, heading toward the center of the millennial kingdom, which is Jerusalem. Verse 5, Persia, which is the ancient name of what we call Iran today, Kush, which is a little bit more troublesome because Kush is actually found in an area close to Persia, but it's also found south of Egypt, because apparently the Kushites, the descendants of the original Kush, located themselves in both areas. But anyway, wherever it is, Kush and Put. Put is located in North Africa. Are with them, and all of them with shield and helmet. Gomer is also in that same region that we're talking about in northern Mesopotamia. All his hordes, Beth Togarmah, from the uttermost parts of the north, with all his hordes, many peoples are with you. So it is clear that the bulk of the invasion comes from the north. It comes from the area we call Turkey and Armenia and Syria and Azerbaijan and Persia and Iran, basically, Iraq. All that region up there is what's being listed here by Ezekiel. Now, in the new heaven and new earth, though, it is interesting that those same regions are on the fringe of the highway of holiness that we've seen described in other millennial passages. And that's where I'm going to start the next time we get back into the Word right here.